to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, returning guest, owner and lead designer for Arkane Games, Chris Park.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Yep, it's great to have you back. So this has been just a crazy and really productive year for Arkane, hasn't it?
Yeah, we've been nonstop.
And if we count expansions as well as standalone games, you guys have released 6 different products over the course of 1 year. Is that right?
Yeah, we've almost doubled our product catalog from 3 years prior to that.
And that's pretty interesting because this has been like the year that I've really paid more attention to independent developers, Kickstarter, crowdfunding. And I find it funny that a lot of the games I've been looking forward to this year have stayed in alpha for the majority of it. And in the span of 1 year, you guys have put out 6 games. And a lot of games have went from alpha to just later on in alpha in that same span of time.
Yeah, well, we have a larger team than a lot of them do. And, you know, at this point, we have a lot more experience as well. And we're not building our code engines from scratch. We're not having to assemble a team and learn how to work together, you know. And the development team is not distracted with having to do the PR side or the marketing side, and all our business relationships are already established and all that sort of thing. So there's a lot of stuff that just doesn't have to happen. You know, back when I was doing AI War, our first game, I spent so much time working on the art. When your programmer / designer is also working on art, that takes forever because, you know, it's not very good at it probably. And, you know, it used to be that even with just an expansion to AI War or something like that, the week after releasing it, I would just be completely gone from being able to do any development because it would just be press. And, you know, the month afterwards still, it's just like so much slowed down. We don't really have that now. It's just, you know, go to the next thing, the artists do the art, you know. So it makes us a lot more lean.
Yeah. Now, I know you said this on previous cast, but how many people work at Arkane now?
At this point, there are 6, is that right? I think it's 6. Yeah, 6 of us.
Now, we've talked about this on previous casts, and for people who haven't followed Arkane, the big change that you talked about, I think this was during Shatterhaven or Valley Without Wind 2's podcast, was Arkane switched from spending a lot of time building these massive games and going for smaller focus titles with like one core mechanic or one main gameplay element, and then basically letting the market decide whether or not to expand on that game and take it up to the levels that we see with like something like AI Wars.
Right, and even AI War, I mean, that started out, you could maybe get 100 hours out of it, and now, you know, after 5 expansions and so on, we have people that have 600 hours into that game. But even with the first version of that, it wouldn't have, you know, been playable for 600 hours, I don't think. But, you know, with Bionic, we've already got some players that have, which that's our latest title, we have some players that already have 80 hours into it. So it's kind of like, well, you know, even with this smaller development process, shorter development process, we still wind up with something that is bigger than I would expect a lot of the times. And part of that is because, you know, with a staff of 6, if it takes us a couple of months, that's a man year, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when I was working by myself and developing the engine and all that for AI War, the original version took me 7 months. So, I mean, you know, in a lot of, you know, real human effort time, Bionic Dudes actually took substantially longer than AI War did, but, and, you know, and that was without doing engine development on top of it. So it's just, it's kind of funny how that works out when you actually do the math.
Now, with so many projects that Arkane has worked on over the year, in terms of, I guess, your team, has your team gotten used to this more rapid development cycle, or are you guys getting tired out, or is it just, you know, the daily grind?
There's really not a sense of rush or anything at this point. I mean, you know, the art staff is, you know, ahead of schedule, and they're feeling pretty relaxed about the next title we're working on. And, you know, the programming is going quickly, and we're ahead of schedule on that, too. And, you know, with Bionic Dudes, we had a month of alpha, and it was really very relaxed for us in that we were able to just put so much time into polish. With Skyward Collapse, we were just rushing, and it was just this nightmare rush at the end. And that was the same for A Valley Without Wind 1, A Valley Without Wind 2, Shattered Haven. It was just this mad rush up to the end. With Bionic, finally, that was not the case at all. And with The Last Federation, which is our next one, that's thus far, you know, it's been a more relaxed thing. I mean, you know, you go to work and you do a certain amount of work each day, and as long as the project has been laid out properly so that there's enough time to do it, there's not a need for a sense of rush.
Now, another aspect, as we talked about, you're not only the lead designer, you're also the owner of Argon. So that leaves you to make some other decisions that other designers wouldn't make, because you have to look at things not only from a design point of view, but simply from a profit point of view or productivity point of view. We've talked about how Arkane is pretty much letting the market decide, in a sense, what games to expand on. And we saw with Shattered Haven that even though I liked it, it wasn't that big of a seller, so you guys decided to put that on the back burner. But with Skyward, I think you announced like a week or a week and a half after release that you were going to work on expansion because the game did that well. My question from a, I guess, more of a business standpoint, how do you decide or what do you look at for your games to decide, okay, we're going to expand this one, or if this game hasn't done well enough, you're just going to let that one slide now?
Well, I mean, that's a fairly straightforward question. I mean, it's, you know, how much money is it making versus, you know, how much money are we spending? I mean, the main question is, how much money is it going to cost us to make an expansion? And do we feel like the sales of the expansion plus the increase in sales of the base game that come along with doing an expansion are going to, you know, meet or exceed the amount of money we spent to make it? And Skyward was actually only our second profitable game since AI War. Valley Without Wind 1, 2, Shattered Haven, Tidalis, those all lost money. And the only reason we stayed around is because AI War made so much money. And so, you know, we have to, you know, this is something that started as my hobby, but as a profession, it's something where it's like, well, you know, can't be self-indulgent or people lose their jobs. And there's no shortage of projects that I want to work on. So if one thing is not getting the reception that we want, then that's okay. I mean, there's plenty of other things that are exciting. So. It's not like, oh no, what do we do now? We have no ideas.
Now, speaking about ideas, since you are looking at both from a business and a design perspective, now that Arkane has shifted to the smaller development time frames and more focused games, has that affected or changed your general perception on game design at all? Or did you make that transition relatively smoothly?
It's actually been a surprisingly smooth transition. I thought it wouldn't be. But it's changed the focus of exactly how we look at where the value for the player is. And there are certain high-value things that we can do where you get, like, multiplicative complexity, basically, out of it. Where, you know, if we add a few new enemy types or whatever into a mix, that's a high-value return because that really can change the game a lot. But adding, like, you know, 300 pieces of background furniture. We had something along those lines in like Valley 2 and even more than that in Valley 1. That's a fairly low value activity because the players hardly notice them and the game is so sprawling you still keep seeing the same background furniture over and over again. But the amount of time and money that it takes to make all that background furniture is just ridiculous. And so the focus then becomes on, okay, well, how can we design games where the player's getting to do something fun and we get right to the fun? There's not any, you know, messing about for a while where you have to, you know, like with Valley 1, there were parts where it's like, okay, if you learn how to play properly, then it's really fun. If you like try and explore every nook and cranny, then that's not a smart way to play and you wind up being like way off, and not having fun. And it's like, well, it's so easy for players who don't want to read to like shoot themselves in the foot. And the game did really well anyway, and people have really enjoyed it. Even though it didn't break even, it sold quite a lot of copies. But, you know, it's shifted our approach a lot in terms of trying to make things more accessible, trying to make things more focused in terms of what will really benefit the player versus just kind of extra clutter. And And I think that also plays back into accessibility.
So that's an interesting point about accessibility, because one of the challenges that we see is that there is this conflict or this push and pull between accessibility and depth. And we can see this in a lot of high-level thinking strategy games or a lot more complex games, stuff like Dwarf Fortress, Crusader Kings, stuff like that. And in those games, you really have to have almost an investment period in them, just trying to learn the basics, trying to learn the UI, before you can even really start to play them. And as you said, with some of your later games, they are really more like of a sit-down-and-play type feel. Like, I don't need to read a manual to understand what I'm doing in Bionic Dudes, for instance. Or, I don't need to, you know, spend hours watching YouTube videos to learn what to do in Skyrim Collapse.
And it's funny, because some people still feel like there's too much of a intro period into Skyward Collapse, you know, and some people are like, oh my god, I was so confused right at the start at Bionic Dudes. It's like, really? Just click a note and get going, you know? But it's, you know, I think it depends on the person's attitude. I think, you know, the Skyward Collapse intro is about as long as, like, Faster Than Light or something like that. That is something we've been thinking about more recently with our next title in particular, The Last Federation, where we're really focusing on the early, you know, what is the player's experience from their first pickup of the game? Because I usually tend to think about what is the mature game like. The Last Federation, the next game that we're working on, instead of thinking about how the game is in a mature state, once you know everything, basically, which I think is kind of the example with, like, Crusader Kings or Dwarf Fortress, you know, it's obviously best experienced when you're at a mature state of understanding of it, but it's also fairly much only experienced at that level. And with The Last Federation, we've been working on carefully designing out how does the game progress in an arc where it's fun right from the get-go, even before you understand all the mechanics, and then by the time you're, you know, internalizing the first mechanics, you're getting the next mechanics, and it's like, okay, you know, I'm ready for more. Ooh, this is great. There's more, you know, which is a bit of a different way of handling it. If you look at a lot of, you know, really scripted games like Braid or whatever, then obviously that's how they've always been designed. It's like what we do with Shattered Haven. It's not something new. But when you're taking it to something that's more open-ended or sandboxy or a strategy game, aside from kind of the little scripted campaigns that a lot of strategy games have that a lot of people don't play. It's like, just give me to the quick matches, right? That doesn't really exist as frequently, at least. So
now, going back to focusing on these smaller development cycles and these more focused games, how do you decide then when one of your games is finished in the sense that what you want is fully expressed and that you can release a game in this state versus, you know, that habit of a lot of designers to just keep adding, keep building, blowing a game up to massive proportions?
That really comes down to judgment and experience. With AI War, the first game I was ever doing, you know, I when I realized I was ready to release or, you know, go into kind of final testing anyway, I still had this, like, long list of features I felt like I needed to add. And then I suddenly hit this point where I was just like, wait a second. This game is huge. I don't need to add any more stuff. You know, it's good enough here. And then put it out and people are like, oh god, it's so giant. And I'm like, okay, well, yeah, I really didn't need to add anything more. You know, with Tidalis, we went and we added, like, everything in the kitchen sink. We really could have stopped way before we did. You know, and with Valley 1, that was, again, something where we just went nuts with content addition. And, you know, for better and for worse, with the newer titles, you know, we're playtesting as we go. And, you know, we're generally able to project, you know, how much, you know, playtime is somebody going to be able to get out of this. You know, how long is it going to take before this gets stale? You know, how many permutations are there? You know, and with, like, Bionic Dudes, for instance, you know, we're like, okay, multiply out the number of different possible scenarios with this many enemies. It's like, okay, it's like 118,000 different possible scenarios. You know, you're not going to run into all those, you know. So it's kind of like, all right, you know, we've got enough there. But then, you know, we still snuck in like another three enemies, which bumps it up to like 180,000 or something like that, different permutations, because we're like, oh, we've got this idea and this is easy and we're in alpha, things are going well, let's do this other little thing, you know, this will be fun. But it's not something that takes like a massive amount of time. And, you know, by the time with the Bionic Dudes timeline, you know, we spent about a month and a portion on prototyping, and that was mostly just with one programmer working on that and myself popping in and out with design. And then we really hit it hard with, you know, a really focused month. We pretty much knocked that game out in a month and had it done. But then we spent a whole other month working on just polish and just refining everything. We had the players, we had several dozen players in who were giving us feedback. And just, there were like 600 or 700 different like issues logged by then that we were just really hitting it hard, in a way to just make it as pristine as we could. And that's kind of what I mean in terms of the time schedule felt kind of relaxed because we already had this game that these people like couldn't put down and were like spending, you know, like 12 hours their first day playing. And we're like, all right, you know, we're onto something here, you know, it's just a matter of refining it now. And, you know, so that process worked out. And it's, I don't know, it's just something you get kind of used to seeing is, you know, how big you need to be. And sometimes I'm surprised when I look at other indie games, I'm like, wow, this is way bigger than it needs to be. And I'm grateful, this is cool. But, you know, for, you know, a $2 iPhone game or something that's got like 160 levels or whatever, like that's, you know, way more value than perhaps is warranted for the effort that went into that. It's hard to break even with that.
Yeah. Now, as you were just talking about in terms of this more focused on accessibility or trying to get really refined first few minutes or making the game easy to understand, Arkane's normal fan base, as I think we talked about, I think with Avowed, without Windcast, is you guys generally tend to appeal to harder core gamers, strategy fans, the people who usually play games at the higher difficulty level, and stuff like that. With your new approach to more focused game or these singular elements, has there been any challenges or hurdles in terms of balancing making a game that appeals to your hardcore fan base versus trying to attract newer or lesser skilled gamers to your titles?
I don't think so. With the Valley games in particular, we got a much more diverse array of people in there. I mean, with AI War, we had just like mainly like the super hardcore folks. I mean, AI War is like the Dwarf Fortress, the strategy games. You know, that is an in-depth game. With Valley, there's really so much more of a range. And so even in our core fan base, like people who are, you know, doing alpha testing with us or giving us lots of feedback in the forums or whatever else, we have a really diverse level of skill. And so we have some people who like crank it up to the highest difficulty during the, you know, final testing period and all that sort of stuff. And they're like, we need more difficulty. I'm doing this and this and this and winning. Can you make it harder? And they've got real specific suggestions on ways we can do that. And then we have other people who are like, yeah, I'm playing it on normal and it feels pretty good. Or, you know, normal feels a little bit easy, but, you know, and other people are like, oh my God, I was overwhelmed. I'm down on easy. You know, and it's like, great. Okay. You know, we've got a good spread. So we wind up actually in our testing period having players who play at all those skill levels. Not at the really super casual end.
Yeah.
So those are just kind of our best guess stabs. And we tend to make that like, you know, as ridiculously easy as we can. But then on like kind of the more serious, easy to ridiculous difficulties, you know, we have a good spread of players there.
And I know that, I think starting with Shatterhaven, you like to have that super, almost impossible difficulty setting. I think you called Shatterhaven, I think it was, what was it like, possibly impossible or something like that?
Oh yeah, that actually goes back all the way to AI War, because that one has 10 difficulty levels in it, and on level 10, it's supposed to be impossible, basically, and anytime anybody's able to beat it or come really close, they'll file a bug report and we'll fix the bug for them. Seriously.
Nice.
It's a cat and mouse game with the players. They love it. You know, it creates a real dedicated subset of players who try and figure out how to beat difficulty 10.
So has anyone actually managed to do it yet? Or have you just been constantly trying to keep ahead of it in a sense?
On difficulty 10? Yeah, we've had some people that have done it in kind of either using cheese tactics or a couple of players who were just really, you know, very clever in certain ways. And, you know, whenever they do it, they tell us exactly how they did it and have plenty of suggestions for how to prevent them from doing it again that way. And, you know, they very much collude with us in, you know, then making it harder again. And, you know, there's a great deal of pride, I think, for the people that managed to do that on 10. And then, you know, that pride also translates into, and now that will never happen again. I was the one who did it, and if anybody else is going to do it, it's going to be a different way, you know. And so it's the newer games that we have, aside from Shattered Haven, I think, don't really have a difficulty that's quite so intense. The highest one, the Misery difficulty in Bionic Goose, is really hard, but it's beatable.
Now, before we go on and talk about Bionic Dudes, I just have a few more set of questions regarding more of the business side of ARK and just your development strategy in that regard. Now, I know last time we got a little bit on topic on early access and crowdfunding. What are your thoughts on that? For this time, I just want to talk a little bit about another aspect behind selling a game that a lot of people may not be too familiar with, and that's the concept of getting on the various stores. Now, obviously, ARK and you sell your games on your own store or on the actual ARK site. But then there's, of course, you know, GOG, Steam. You've been on the Humble Bundle a few times as well. I know that. So from a, I guess it's more of a business-related question. How do you decide, or I guess how do you focus on what stores to pitch ARK's games for? Or is it more of you just try to go and hit everyone equally?
You know, when we were new, we try and hit everybody up. And over time, you know, we've learned who the, you know, kind of key partners are. And, you know, at this point, we have established relationships with pretty much everybody. And so we're just like, here's our next game. And they're like, okay. With some of the stores that we weren't previously working with, like Green Man Gaming or GOG, they actually approached us, so we never did pitch them on it. They came to us. And, you know, with GOG, we only have worked with them with some of our stuff because we tend to do expansions, and they don't sell stuff that is going to have separate DLC later. And so only on our titles that we're sure we're not going to do any more expansions have we worked with them. And so that's been something that I hope to see, you know, shift over there, because, you know, I am very against horse armor just as much as they are, and I'm very much against, you know, DRM just as much as they are. I share a lot of their values, but I also think that expansions are, you know, a really good thing and actually a good value for both customers and the developer, because it's something where you can get a bunch more content for something you already like for a reasonable price, as long as it's a good value expansion. And so it's, you know, that's pretty much our process now.
Yeah, expansions are definitely one of those tricky elements. I mean, we've seen that sort of change with the whole digital distribution as well. I mean, back in, like, well, like early 2000s, definitely the 90s, you would buy an expansion that was pretty much like a $20, $30 deal right there. But nowadays, thanks to digital distribution, you can release like a $5, $6 expansion to a game, and maybe it only includes, you know, 2-3 more hours of content versus having someone spend $30 on what could be basically a whole nother game in itself.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, different people do it different ways. And, you know, for us, we tend to have, you know, each of our expansions tends to add, you know, dozens of more hours to stuff, and we still sell them for, you know, $5 or $10, generally speaking. And a lot of that, again, comes down to multiplicative complexity of, you know, if you're making a linear game, adding 3 more hours of content is a lot more of a challenge than if you're making something where it's procedural and you add more procedural elements, then it just balloons the amount of time that is available there. So, you know, it's apples and oranges, but, or something like the Civilization series, you know, they added all the religion stuff and, you know, a bunch of other mechanics that are like large mechanics into their existing game with some of their expansions. And that adds so much more time to the Civilization experience as well, simply because there's so many more ways to play now. And so there's, you know, more reason to go back and play more and more games of Civilization. And, you know, I think their expansions actually are, they're at least $20. I think they're $30, but, you know, but they're still a good value. You know what I mean? So, yeah. And then they have all those little $3 things that are like, you know, one civ and, you know.
New animation, new maps, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Now, another aspect of game on all these stores is having your game on sale. And this has become another major deal with digital distribution over the last few years. We've seen games go from like $50 to $10. I bought like a week ago or 2 weeks ago on the not on Steam sale, I bought a few games for like 99 cents. I know with Ark, I know you guys try to balance around the major holidays and stuff like that, but how do you decide like more like the most prudent times to have like a 50% off sale?
It's really a little more of an art than a science. It's there are certain times of the year where it's not a good idea to bother. Like in August and September, those are just dead months. And if there's a big holiday sale or other sort of event sale, like the Spring Indie Bundle or, you know, whatever, Spring Indie Sale that Valve did this past year, you know, it's not a good idea to have a sale like right around that time. So, you know, we try and balance our own stuff kind of in the cracks between those, and then also pay attention to, you know, how long has it been since it was last on sale and where was it last on sale. And, you know, we get approached by the various distributors saying, hey, we'd like to include this in this particular sale, or it's been a while since we've done a sale on this, do you want to do blah blah. And, you know, we'll say, you know, usually we'll go along with that, and then we suggest our own as well. And it's something that comes up organically. And, you know, sometimes it's in response to cash flow type stuff where it's like, you know, this has not been going as well as we hope or whatever, you know, we better run a sale. And, you know, so that's something, too, that works.
Cool. All right. So I think with that, we can move on and talk a little bit about Bionic Dudes. So when you were here last time, you were, I think at that point, starting to develop the game. So I guess to begin with, where did the original idea for Bionic Dudes come from?
You know, all of these games that we do really aren't any one single idea. They're usually kind of a mesh of ones. You know, we wanted to do a roguelike. People have been asking us to do a roguelike for years. And, you know, it's something that a lot of our staff really enjoys playing. So we're like, all right, we want to do a roguelike, but there's a bunch of roguelikes. We don't want to do just a roguelike. You know, we want to do kind of a tactics game plus there. And so, you know, we had all these plans for ways to accomplish that. You know, really none of the original plans that we had came to fruition. They you know, we went through prototype after prototype, and it just wasn't feeling right. It was kind of clunky, it was slow to move around, it didn't feel right, we couldn't get it to graphically look right because of some of the design decisions we were making there and stuff. And so but through that we wound up coming up with a system where, you know, the movement and the combat was able to be kind of fluid, and we were like, all right, well, this is going somewhere, this is good. You know, and ranged combat is, you know, only ranged combat is fairly unusual in roguelikes. And we'd had the idea early on, it was actually Keith's idea, not mine, to have the idea of the robots being intentionally buggy and thus doing things. And that actually was just like a super good idea, because that means they can act both in a manner that's, you know, funny, but also in a way that is non-optimal in the sense that, you know, you would think that a robot would just run at you shooting your face, but if that's what they all do, that's, again, kind of non-optimal. And so, but, you know, they're non-optimal by being too optimal. And so by having them have all these, like, crazy behaviors and, you know, like, disabilities, and some having, you know, special positive abilities, it makes it so that you run into this kind of shifting landscape of stuff. And, you know, so we saw that, and we saw, okay, the movement's really, you know, coming along the way the shooting's moving along. It's like, okay, let's focus this down, make it a little more focused on the roguelike side, less on the tactics side in the sense of, like, squad tactics. And so we made it so you could only have one XO out at a time, but you could switch between them so you still have a squad, but it's not, you know, you're not managing the whole squad at once, because that was one of the things that just really slowed it down. And that was a really good decision. And from there, it was like, you know, oh, well, you know, here's more ways we can make this more tactical. And, you know, we got a really tactical feel out of it, more so than a lot of roguelikes, I feel, kind of coming around the back door, sort of.
Yeah. Now, as you were just saying about trying to make the game quicker, make it less tactical, more roguelike, when you talk about the game and how it's built on Ark Insight, that it's more of a roguelite, that it doesn't feature as much complexity or difficulty as you would see in a typical roguelike. Now, during the development of Bionic Dudes, were there any systems or mechanics that were more roguelike-ish in nature that you decided to simplify or just outright remove in the name of making the game quicker to play?
Not really. There were some things that we thought we might add that we wound up not doing. I mean, we thought we might have, like, enemy sensors, and then you could, like, jam them and some other things like that. But it got into situations where it was hard to visually represent what was going on there. And so it's kind of like, well, you know, this is going to be hard to communicate to the player, and what is this actually adding, you know? And so, you know, we did cut some stuff like that, but we hadn't actually added it. It was just okay in the design, you know? So it was like, you know, this is something we're going to do. It's like, no, this is not something we're going to do. And, you know, some players have, enterprising players have gone through the art files and discovered, you know, various modules that we did the art for and we had designed for, but that didn't get added in the game, and they're like, oh, look, we could have had these things. It's like, yeah, you went over those things. You know, that's, but, you know, as part of that, as those sort of things happen, you know, we were also constantly coming up with other new stuff that we had not planned on from the start. So it just kind of always evolves in a way that you don't really expect. You wind up with less of some of the stuff that you had initially planned and way more of stuff that you found out was cool as you went.
Now, another aspect of Bionic Dudes that's different from all the roguelikes is the progression model. Typically, in a roguelike, there's more of an RPG side of leveling up, choosing perks, skills, stuff like that. But in Bionic, you just have your choice of the initial set of exos, and then, if you can, finding the epic upgrade, or the Bahamut, I think?
Bahamut
upgrade. How did you decide on those specific exos to have in the game versus, I guess, like, other versions or other, I guess, functional characters?
Well, bear in mind, there is an RPG-like progression in the sense of in the procedural loot, you know, yeah. And that's where all your stats come from. And so instead of it being a personal leveling up and a personal stat perk sort of thing, you've got, you know, various perks on all the different parts, and the number of slots that are there is, you know, like, ridiculous. A lot of them have like 16 slots for one exo, and you can put all these different parts in there and give them a bunch of different perks, and the parts have levels and all that. So, you know, those kind of RPG-ish elements are there in the parts, but, you know, I didn't feel like a second level on the exos themselves was also needed. The whole thing with the exos themselves and with the epic versions you get from the Bahamut moments. This actually was inspired by Final Fantasy I, which, surprise, nobody's ever mentioned this. The name Bahamut should give it away. But, yeah, like with Final Fantasy I, you start out and you have a team of, you know, four heroes, the Warriors of Light that you choose. And, you know, you can choose, like, Fighter, White Mage, Reg Mage, Black Mage, Thief, Black Belt. And, they each have a different combat role, and eventually you go, you know, bring a rat's tail to the dragon Bahamut, and he turns them into, like, the epic versions of themselves. And, you know, we're like, that's really cool, let's do that, basically. And the name, you know, the Bahamut Machine here was, you know, direct nod to Final Fantasy I. And the specific classes that we chose, I mean, it's just kind of different combat roles. So originally we had a tank role, they would work kind of like you'd think from an MMO, but didn't really make a whole lot of sense in this context. It was okay, it just was kind of unexciting. And so we wound up changing that into the ninja, which was a lot more interesting and stealthy. We had some suggestions from players about that during the kind of the alpha period. That's when it changed from tank into ninja. All the other ones were there from the start, where it's like, you know, we need a kind of glass cannon heavy that shoots from way off, you know, okay, the siege, and kind of the general running and gunning guy, the assault, and, you know, we really wanted the science guy who would be, like, all into good with the hacking and the other special abilities, and but kind of stink at combat. But then his epic version has this awesome chain gun. So there's also this kind of delayed gratification if you want to get him and then wait. And then, you know, the sniper, you know, kind of that extra range and all that sort of stuff, but limited ammo. And and then the brawler, where that was kind of a trickier one to come up with, because it was like, well, you know, where else do we have a role that would fit? And it's like, well, this guy who's fairly tough, but not really tankish per se, and he's just brutal up close, but he's not, you know, he's okay at mid-range. And, you know, through customizations and stuff, you can make that guy really freakishly scary by either increasing his range or giving him a lot of stealth or whatever, and he's just really get in there and kick some butt. So, you know, it came out of thinking, you know, what are the different combat roles and how can we make these as different as possible, not just in small ways, but just broadly different roles. And of course, with all the customization with the parts, the players get into all the subtle stuff, you know, where you get to make your own version of, you know, the running and the gunning guy, you know.
Now, speaking about the parts and where that is RPG or the personalization comes in, was there a point during development that the player could equip new guns or new shields, or did you settle on the loot being the progression model fairly early in the design?
Oh, we knew from the start we were never going to allow switching of guns. The idea was to make it so that, because that's part of what makes the individual exos unique. If you start letting an assault guy equip a sniper rifle, you wind up just making it cross the lines, you know what I'm saying? Uh-huh. And so with, if you take, let's say, Final Fantasy, you know, your white mage is unable to equip a sword, and your fighter can equip a sword, and then he gets a better sword, and he gets a better sword, and he gets a better sword, and a better sword, and occasionally there's a couple that you might get to choose from, but mostly it's just a progression from, you know, let's swap out swords. And we're like, well, you know, we don't want to do that. There's no reason to do that. And with, like, let's say Borderlands, you know, if you're playing somebody who's got a shotgun, you know, you've got your shotgun, and then later you find a better shotgun in certain ways, but they all have randomized stats because that's procedural too. So it's like, all right, I'm going to take this shotgun over that shotgun. We didn't really want to do that because it was like, let's build your own shotgun. Maybe you build a quasi-sniper shotgun, you know what I mean? Yeah. Where it's got this ridiculous range for a shotgun, or maybe you're focusing on just like brute damage or whatever. So there's not really a reason to let them swap out the weapons, because it's kind of like build your own weapon, okay. Except in the broad sense of let's have an actual identity to the class. You know what I mean? You can't make a sniper out of an assault guy, which is by design.
Yeah. And I just want to go back to the Bahamut mention for a second. Now I'm kicking myself, because I recently played Final Fantasy 1 again a few years ago, and now that you said it, just all clicked in that, that's just how it was then. Now, with the ability to choose your four different exos, and just like back in Final Fantasy, being able to choose your four party members, are there any combinations of exos that the game has just said that it's unwinnable? Or is the game sort of balanced or designed in a way that if I want to take a party or four science guys or four ninjas, that I can still make do in some sense of the word?
I don't know, to be honest. The game does not adapt to what you bring. Same as Final Fantasy 1. Final Fantasy 1, you would think that you couldn't win with four black mages, or even worse, four white mages, but some folks have done it.
Really?
And it's, yeah, there's stuff online, you can look it up, where people, like, it's considered like one of the epic challenge run type things to do. And when I was a kid, I would play like four fighters, and it was awful. It was so hard, you know. And there's a lot of combinations that you can use in Bionic that all work, you know, have a chance of working. And a large part of that is you can emphasize which kinds of missions you do in order to kind of augment your specific party. If you take four science guys, you're in for some hurt.
Yeah.
Depending on your difficulty level, you could probably do it, you know, particularly if you take the character Genji, so they all start out as epic, and then you've got the chain gun at least on all of them, and that would help a lot. You know, so it's theoretically feasible. Not playing with Genji and playing with four science guys on misery difficulty, I don't know about that. Maybe. Players surprise me. Players always surprise me. I love it. Somebody's going to do it.
Yeah, probably. But
I can't do it, I'll tell you that.
Now, speaking about how the game doesn't adapt itself to the player's choices and whatnot, as a quick aside, I was just wondering, one of the enemies I ran into during my game was the Scrambler bot, the one that every time you try to shoot at him, it causes your bullet to hit a random square. Is there a way to take that guy out without using, like, a siege or splash damage weapon? Because I couldn't really find... Okay.
It takes a little bit of RNG luck, but ground fire right next to him, and you'll still miss one of the four directions, but if one of those four is him, you got him.
Okay, cool. Yeah, because that guy was just driving me nuts when I got to him for the first time. I'm like, what the hell? My sniper, I can't hit him. I was like, you know what?
Right.
Screw it. Take the grenade launcher out of my assault and just boom, blow the whole area up.
Right. It's a lot easier if you use something with at least slight AoE. But if you, if you're playing a party that doesn't have any AoE, he's still, you know, quite killable. It's just you end up with a 25% miss chance on every shot you take at him.
Now, as you said that the upgrade system was inspired by Final Fantasy I, the actual endgame of Final Fantasy II is different compared to other roguelites in the sense that you have this somewhat hard limit of 50 days of in-game time, which can be affected through missions. Where did the inspiration come from to have this different type of ending compared to other roguelikes where it's, you know, take your time, build up, and then when you're ready, go down to the final boss or the final level and, you know, hope that you're geared enough for it?
Well, the bulk of the roguelikes, I mean, they have a finite cap as well. They don't call them days, but I mean, there's however many floors, you know, 100 floors or whatever, and you can't get 101 floors if you want. I mean, that's how big the space is. Yeah. So we said, you know, we don't want 100 floors. We want, you know, let's go with 50 and let them make it even quicker if they want to attack these certain areas. And so, you know, we basically look at each mission as a floor, but instead of it being like, okay, this is the next floor, I'm handing it to you. It's okay, you know, choose your next floor based on how you want to affect the overall situation. And then instead of having this static final boss, we wanted there to be this back and forth where you see what's coming. You know, there's the army right there in the sidebar on the city map of this is what you're going to be facing. And you can either work on weakening them or strengthening yourself or some mix of both as you're playing. And that way, there's not just this kind of surprise, random kick in the teeth at the end. There's actually some longer-term strategic thinking to it. And that really gives kind of a meta context to what you're doing, which is something that we really valued all along. Because, you know, with a lot of roguelikes, it's like, okay, you know, go through all the floors and get to the bottom. And there's not really context for why you're doing that. It's just you're there to go get the guy. But at any rate, there's a less context, and we thought it was fun to have, you know, more of an ongoing back and forth.
When I wrote in my review of Final Fantasy, it sort of reminded me of the game Sid Meier's Colonization, with how the end game is sort of determined by your actions. Like, I think in that game, based on how big you build or how much you oppose the British Empire, that would determine the wave or the size of the enemy force that would come to kill you. So I thought that was kind of interesting in Bionic Dudes, and how, as you said, you can sort of split between, do I want to make myself stronger, or do I want to make them weaker? But then, of course, there's that risk that if you fail the mission, nothing gets accomplished, but you move time forward by one day.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, you can go and attack their training grounds and, like, shoot up a bunch of their little guys, or go try and assassinate their bosses, or whatever, but, yeah, if you don't accomplish much in those, then you've kind of wasted a day, because the loot you get from that is not, you know, wonderful compared to the loot you might get elsewhere. So, you know, I never did play Colonization, but that's really cool to hear that there was a similarity there.
I played like a little bit of it, but I just remember reading like Let's Plays and stuff like that about the game and how it sort of had like a variable ending. Like, you still, if you couldn't beat them, you're going to lose, but depending upon how you played would determine the strength of the enemy at the end.
Right, that's cool.
Now, another part of Final Fantasy II that I want to talk about are the missions. As you said, different missions will will basically either strengthen yourself or weaken the enemy. Now, besides having missions around finding, you know, better weapons, better shields, or the weakened ones to attack their training, attack their react reductions, there's also a bunch of, I guess, more like unique missions. There's ones where there's a lot more explosives, there's the one when you're being chased by, like, the unkillable robot, stuff like that. How did you decide what missions to add to the game? Were there any mission types that were left in the design stage that weren't included in the final product?
Actually, we came up with all 22 mission types pretty much all in one go one day early, once we knew it was, you know, a roguelike and all that, once we were getting into, you know, real solid early production of it. Came up with them all in one go, and we did all of them. We didn't cut anything, and a lot of it's just, you know, it's thinking of riffs on stuff, right? You know, it's like, okay, these are the mechanics. Now, how can I break the normal rules? Well, what if everything was exploding? You know, that would be interesting. Or, you know, well, what if every shot, you know, every bullet had did like, you know, 100,000 damage, so anybody who got touched, you know, in the slightest dies. You know, that would encourage some stealth and, you know, a lot of sniping and stuff. That would be interesting. And, you know, oh, you know, the one with the murder bot that's coming after you, that's actually inspired. That was my idea. It was inspired by, there's a scene in Silent Hill 2 where Pyramid Head is chasing you and Maria down a hall. And, you know, you just are running down the hall and get to the elevator and some stuff happens. I won't spoil it. Somebody's not played it. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That scene is what inspired the Murderbot. And actually, the golden gun mode in GoldenEye 007 for the N64 is what inspired the overdrive mode in overdrive missions, rather. There's one-hit kills in Bionic. We called them golden amplifiers at first because reference to golden gun, but then it was like, that was not clear. So it was like, okay, we'll call these overdrive. That's a lot more clear.
I just love how all these, like, random game references made their way into Bionic 2.
That's with all our games. We're just filled with them.
Now, another aspect of the design that I wanted to talk about is the pilot choices. So, when you're choosing your team of four, you also choose a pilot, and you already brought up one earlier, the guy who basically starts out with all four epics already unlocked. But then you have characters, I forget the name of the guy, who basically has the map revealed from the start when he starts a mission out.
Yeah, Tuck.
And then there's characters, I think the woman that, when you first start the game, like, she's sort of pre-selected, who all her gear, I think, operates at, like, two or three levels above what someone else would choose for that gear.
Yeah, Meg.
So I think, as you mentioned, that these characters, I think this was mentioned in the actual screen, that these characters basically have very much overpowered bonuses, but you can only choose one to be your bonus for the game. How did you decide on the design behind these characters and their superpowered buffs that they would provide?
This was more of a challenge, and we actually wound up discarding two or three different buffs and swapping them out because they just weren't powerful enough. With these, we wanted to make it so that you could have some sort of extreme advantage of some sort, but only one, and that they would all be, you know, generally speaking, in the same realm of equal, where everybody would find, you know, where somebody would find everything valuable. And that is that was a process that took us longer. It was just kind of like, we wanted to have one of our big rules. Keith was bigger on this than me, the big rule was, it can't be something that you could normally get through like a parts bonus. So we discarded all sorts of stuff that would have been too tame, that would have just been like, well, you could make this some other way in the game. It was like, no, this needs to be stuff that no other way in the game can you get this. It's just from the pilot, so it feels awesome when you choose this. But then you're like, oh, but I didn't do this other stuff, you know. So.
And as you said, they're pretty much like any other game. They could be considered game breaking. But here, it's sort of, you know, more like you're ace in the hole, in a manner of speaking.
Right. And it depends on how you play. I mean, Genji, the guy who gets all the epics at the start, I mean, his advantage basically is a temporal one, you know what I mean? Because you can get those epics later anyway, and he's saving you, depending on how many different types of exos you have, up to 4 days worth of missions you'd have to do in order to unlock the epics normally. And he's giving you stronger power in the early game, but he's not really benefiting you as much in the late game aside from giving you 4 extra days to do something else. Versus Meg, you know, she's got the 2 extra, you know, all of her loot is kind of the equivalent of 2 levels higher. That's useful the whole game long. Yeah. But like Axis, she's able to see more of the map, and so she's able to kind of leap over missions, and so you can kind of skip cruddy missions that, you know, don't really have the rewards that you want. They're not what you're looking for, but they're in the way of something that you actually do want really bad. And so she can be so much more targeted, and that kind of, you know what I mean? Yeah. So there's just all these things. I think Tuck is actually probably the weakest one, but he's still popular. He's the one that can, you know, pre-scout a lot of the map in the missions, but he is popular still because some players like the idea of being able to see the objectives and how to go. And I can see even on a high difficulty level where that would be helpful because you need the shortest route.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like he'll help you figure that out. And so it can save you some exploration time.
And there's also the guy thing you said, or in the character description, this guy's like the most like cheesiness over power, the one who he can basically, when he loses an exo, he basically swaps an identical version of that exo, and so he basically has, well, I think, does he have, like 8 lives as opposed to 4 for everyone else?
It's 6, but okay. Yeah, and that one is probably the one that's it's easiest in some respects, but, you know, they're really just kind of mulligans,
yeah.
And so if you're playing uncautiously, you know, you're still getting obliterated with him. So it's he's not like a surefire way to win or anything like that. And in their way, you know, Meg or, you know, Emma is the other one. She gets like twice as much stuff in the store. And it includes legendary items there. And, of course, they're pricey. But she gets her pick of exactly what sort of loot she wants. Where normally, you know, in a roguelike, you've got so much randomization in the loot,
yeah.
And she's able to kind of short circuit that to some degree and get some really amazing loot that's precisely, you know, close to what she wants for a price. And that is something that some people really overlook, and they're like, oh, I don't use the store much. And like, really? And some people are like, oh, I can't play with anybody but Emma, you know.
Yeah.
So we kind of know we're doing it right then when, you know, some people are, you know, really discounting something and other people are really, really into it. You're like, yeah, that's what we want to see.
All right. Now, one final question then before we move on and talk about the last Federation briefly is the future of Bionic Dudes. Now, I know when I was just looking at the forum a few days ago that you're working on an update to Bionic Dudes right now.
Yeah, I mean, we've got several updates that we've pushed out that are in a beta branch there on Steam. And, you know, once those have been, you know, sufficiently tested, basically, by the people who decide to opt into the beta branch, then we'll merge that into the main branch. So, yeah.
All right. And I know, as we've talked about, with Ark taking the wait-and-see approach in terms of expansions, are you guys preparing to do any kind of expansion work for Bionic Dudes at this point?
Yeah, we're, it's, you know, never 100% sure when we're at this far out, but we're very highly likely to do one that would launch in January or February.
In terms of mechanics or new stuff to add, I know with Skyward Collapse you added in the Japanese faction, you updated the resource model, and you've implemented, you know, the civilian buildings. So for Bionic Dudes, what system or what mechanic do you think you would like to add in the next expansion?
Well, there's a number of different things. For one thing, you know, even more enemies provides, you know, yet more variety, which is something that is obviously at the forefront. Another big thing is, and I forget the word for this, it's escaping me at the moment. They're in some various other roguelikes where basically you accept some conditions where you say, you know, something like, I'm not going to use earth magic or whatever, you know, my god gets mad at me sort of thing. And we're going to be doing some things along those lines where at the start of the game, you can accept some restrictions on how you play, and it makes for kind of special challenges that that have some various benefits and all that. And there's some other stuff we have in the works too, but it's there's definitely no shortage of ideas, so it was a matter of narrowing it down to what we wanted to do in the first one.
Okay. Are there any plans to add new exopaths or new epic forms or just new standalone exos? Or the ones that are in the game right now, is that pretty much going to be locked for right now?
We probably will add, you know, if we add a new exo, we'd also be having an epic version. We probably will add some more exos at some point. Whether or not they'll be in the first expansion is still slightly up in the air to me. It just depends on exactly where we put the focus. But that's, you know, there's definitely a lot of different things that we want to do.
Oh.
And,
okay, so I guess just to wrap up the cast set, let's talk a little bit about the Last Federation. I guess the first question then is, what is the Last Federation about?
So, we haven't said a whole lot about this one yet, and it's still pretty early in terms of in talking about it, but it's basically a game set in a solar system that is experiencing various degrees of strife, you know, ranging from war to just pirates and stuff. And you are a mercenary fleet, a real small one to start out with, that you take on contracts and, you know, to fight pirates or do other various things. And you are actually kind of on a secret self-appointed mission to help improve the quality of life on the various planets in the solar system, and use your increasing kind of influence over them to get them to form a solar federation. And so, you know, the ultimate goal of the game is to form a solar federation, and you don't play as a government. You're kind of this, you know, puppet master behind the scenes, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, they all know you. It's not like they don't know who you are. They're hiring you for stuff, but they don't really necessarily fully comprehend how much you're pulling the strings on them. So it's a strategy game mixed with some tactical bits. You know, fairly 4X's in a lot of respects.
Is the general gameplay, like, more real-time, or is it more, like you said, command or like more turn-based design?
It's, for the most part, plausible real-time. It's the specific pacing of some of it is still things we're working out. You know, because there's playing on the solar map and then playing on the in actual battles. And the solar map pacing is one thing that we're still kind of in playtesting on to see what exactly feels most natural. I have a feeling that'll wind up being plausible real-time, but we've been contemplating making it turn-based. There's only a slight difference in some respects between having it be one and the other, you know what
yeah.
I mean? But, you know, so that's where we are on that.
Now, you mentioned that there's going to be combat in the game. Is it more like I command ships, or is it more like I basically say what ships I want to fight and they go out and do their business?
You're commanding a small... You have a fleet, but you're dispatching a ship at a time for the most part, and dealing with that one ship's combat and the little subships that it deploys and all that sort of stuff. It has little drones.
Now, as we talked about with a lot of your previous games, and they're always like that replayability factor of having like different scenarios or different random events to show up. Is there anything like that in the Last Federation to make each game its own different experience?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, where the planets are different. You know, there's 4 different zones in the solar system, pretty much like ours. It's really, there's 5, but there's 4 that have planets. You know, there's the inner solar system, which in our case we're defining as just the stuff inside the habitable zone. So in other words, it's too close to the sun normally to support Earth-like life. So, you know, that would be like Mercury in our solar system. But there's folks that actually live there, you know, like in domes and whatnot. And then there's the habitable zone, which is, you know, Earth-like planets and, you know, Venus and so on, but, you know, more livable. And then you've got the asteroid belt, which there's no planets in, but that's where the pirates come from. And then you've got the outer solar system, which is mostly gas giants and similar. And then you've got, normally in our system, we call it the Trans-Neptunian belt, but, I mean, obviously that's referring specifically to a planet in our system, which is not really quite relevant. So we're calling it the ice belt, which is, I think I've heard that called that in other science fiction as well. And so that creates a, so anyway, you have those four zones, and which zones you're, there's eight planets always, and which zones your eight planets show up in and where on the map they are makes a big difference. There's eight different alien races, and which alien race gets assigned to what planet makes a big difference. And there's various random events that pop up in, you know, what contracts are offered to you and, you know, what the pirates do. And there's what the different political states between the various races and what their planets are like, you know, if two guys in the inner system are at war versus a couple of folks that are further apart or whatever. You know, those sort of things make it pretty different. So there's definitely a lot of there's multiple layers of things that get randomized, and that's something that I always like. Oh, and the attributes of the planets themselves are randomized too. So, you know, what resources they have and, you know, so forth and so on. So even if it's the same race as you met in a different game, you know, the resources they have on their planet would be different. So it's always a little bit of a different puzzle as to how to make them all get along and, you know, beat up some pirates in the process. or you know, subjugate the planet if you want to make them a fear ally, you can do that too. But it's a little difficult. But
now, you mentioned that the goal of the game is to have this solar system federation. Are there any, like, alternate goals, like, you know, a la civilization, or is that just the main goal for every game?
That's the main goal for every game. It's everything in the game is really oriented around that, you know, in terms of just all of the mechanics center around that. Just like if you think about, you know, an RTS game, all of the mechanics are oriented around, you know, how do you beef up your military and then go kill the other guy, and killing the other guy is how you win. In this particular case, you know, you're fighting frequently and maintaining your, you know, military and stuff is important. But even that is still a tool towards ultimately forming the Federation. Everything is built around that. And so, you know, there's a tension between, you know, are you forming the Federation, you know, getting progress towards forming the Federation quickly enough versus, you know, are the pirates and whatnot, you know, kind of pulling ahead of you militarily. You know, you can't just sit there and, like, beef up your military and then, like, just roll the game afterwards. There's that tension there of, well, is my military good enough for now? Can I sink resources into just, like, helping this planet, or what should I do? You know, so it makes for some interesting choices there. And having multiple goals is something that I like a lot of the time, but I feel like having a really deep goal that's difficult to
do, or, like, multiple ways to accomplish that one goal?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
You know, because you could go in kind of this war of conquest and, you know, subjugate everybody, make everybody your fear ally, and then tell them, all right, you're Federation now, you know. And that would be really difficult, and you'd be kind of a jerk. But, but I mean, you could do it. And, you know, you could also do that kind of partially. But, you know, more often than not, you're trying to kind of trick them into getting along with one another, or, you know, do enough stuff that you can kind of tell them what to do, but since you've got enough influence on them, and yada yada.
Cool. All right, one last question then, and then we can start wrapping things up. As we talked about with Bionic Dudes, you were inspired by a lot of classic games for, like, a lot of the elements for Bionic Dudes. Were there any older games or inspirations that sort of helped you when you started coming up with The Last Federation?
There's always influences in everything, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
With this one, since it's another space game, really wanted to do something very different from AI War, and I also really wanted to do something that focused on something other than just kind of life, you know, conquest. And so there was a lot of anti-inspiration, I suppose I would put it, in terms of, like, all right, well, we don't want to do that. Let's see, you know, how could we make it interesting to be pursuing these more you know, non-military goals through military means. And so, you know, civilization is certainly an influence because of, like, some of the tech tree stuff and all that. And some of the more exploration-focused sort of games, like Star Control or, you know, Space Rangers or whatever, were various inspirations. This is not really an exploration-focused game because you're trying to get a set number of planets to kind of play nice. And if there were, like, anywhere near as many civilizations as you run into in Star Control, that would be just madness.
Yeah.
But, you know, the interrelationships and so forth are a lot more complex here, which is something I'd kind of wanted in Star Control as well. And then, you know, with the combat, you know, there have been a lot of various influences on that, and we've been going through iterations after iteration on it. So it's the combat's still a work in progress, but we're pleased with how it's evolving.
Awesome. So I think with that, we can wrap things up for the cast this week. Chris, as always, it was great having you on.
Yeah, it was great to be on, as always.
And if we don't talk again before Last Federation, I hope you guys have a great new year.
Right. Thanks. Same to you.
Yeah. And I'll be looking forward to Last Federation. So you're looking at January, February, like the same time frame as the first expansion for that game?
For Bionic, it'll be pretty much, I'll be very, very surprised if Last Federation's not January, and Bionic will probably be February, but I don't know, it could be earlier. That one is a kind of, we'll see.
Awesome. All right, so we're going to end things here for this week. Make sure to tune in next week for our special Halloween edition of the Perceptive Podcast, where we'll be focusing all on horror design, and generally the games that scare the crap out of us. And as always, if you would like to be a contributor to Game Wisdom, either via writing a piece or for being a future podcast guest, feel free to send us an email. You can find all the information under Submissions Wanted on the front page. That's where the guidelines are for writing for the site, as well as the email link if you are interested in just being a guest. With that said, thank you for tuning in to the Perceptive Podcast this week. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next week. Take care, everybody.